Hello, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. We are finishing up reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere by Deborah Marquardt. It was published by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group, in 2006. Professor Marquardt has been talking about her reactions, her experiences at the time of her father's death. I think I'm going to back up about a paragraph to start this topic. Since my father died, I've been finding dimes on jogging trails, in corridors of hotels, several times at odd hours on the sidewalk leading to my office building at the university where I teach. I don't expect anyone to believe this. At last count, I've picked up 64 in the 9 years since my father's death. They collect on my writing table in 2 etched liqueur glasses. 8 more dimes ride on the dashboard of my car with my sunglasses, the lucky ones I found while traveling that never made it back to the liqueur glasses. 20 or so more dimes hide in my coats and suit jackets. I rediscover them when I reach into my pocket while teaching or singing. I've picked these up along the path and have neglected to deposit them in the glasses. About 12 dimes sit in a shot glass on the counter of my friend's apartment because after he met me a few years ago, he started finding dimes. And now my niece and my mother have begun to find them. But how did it begin? Immediately after my father's funeral, the house was full of cousins, babies, old people, young people. I wondered who would dare to sit in his chair, a lazy boy so thoroughly his that it retained a small oil spot on the upholstery where he rested his head in the end, when he was too sick to go out. No one sat in his chair that day. People milled around it, crowded together on the couch, creaked on the folding chairs. The lazy boy remained unoccupied, except for a single silver dime that rested in the center of the cushion all afternoon. I never picked it up, but the image of that thin flash of silver against the green upholstery stayed with me. After that, the dimes began to appear. In my tally, I don't include the one I saw that first day, or the dozens I saw lying around in the months after my father's death, before I realized that I was finding dimes. At some point, I picked them up and began counting. Sometimes they come in rushes or clusters. 3, for example, in a neat pile under a table at the St. Louis airport, one stormy morning after a turbulent early flight, during which, flying through torrents of rain and great flashes of light, I felt compelled to ask several times, "Just exactly what happens when a plane gets struck by lightning?" I never got the answer, or my morning coffee, because the pilot had instructed the nervous flight attendants to stay in their seats. I exited the plane, shaky-legged, and determined never to fly TWA again, not even to board my connecting flight to Reno. The dimes were in a tiny pile on the newly mopped floor, directly beneath my table when I sat down to eat my breakfast. To be fair, I never pick up the dimes I see around parking meters or in bars or other places where people might be distracted or inebriated or fumbling with their change. Sometimes I see a shiny thing on the ground, I also must confess, and when I reach to pick it up, it's only a bottle cap or a gum wrapper. Sometimes I can go for months without finding one. Then, one Christmas Eve day, I'll be feeling especially sad because of all the holiday music, and I'll lose one of my favorite earrings while shopping for last-minute presents. and when I backtrack to Pier 1 and rap on the darkened windows and question the custodial staff who've just swept the floor, and I am told, very patiently by these workers who just want to get home to their families, that they did not see a delicate silver earring shaped like a leaf with a small pearl. I will feel disheartened when I go back to my car, which in my haste I've left running in the middle of the parking lot with the headlights on. The snow will be slashing at angles through the headlights as I'm sitting there feeling bad about Christmas, when I see something shiny flashing in the parking lot just ahead of me, in the very spot where I had parked hours earlier. And when I get closer, I'll be amazed to discover my lost earring, looking pristine and not stomped on or crushed by tires. And then, when I bend down to pick it up, I'll see something else shiny below. And when I clear the snow with my gloves, I'll discover, suspended in a thin layer of ice, directly below the spot where my earring had landed, one thin dime. More signs and wonders. The Monday morning after my father died, I met with my summer class to tell them that I'd be leaving town for a few days for his funeral. My students were appalled that I had bothered to come to class. What is the appropriate thing to do when someone you love dies? Tear your clothes? Lie down and kick and scream? Or quietly go on with assigned tasks? I still don't know. All I could think of was that my students had essays due that morning, and I didn't want to disappoint them by not showing up to collect them. After I dismissed the class, one student came up to tell me how sorry he was about my loss. He was an older, long-haired student, one of my favorites because he had actual life experiences to write about. Now he wanted to confess something. The essay he had written was about his father. He was proud that he had written about how much he loved and valued his father, but now he hesitated to turn in the essay. He worried that reading it might sadden me. "No," I said, gathering my papers, "don't worry. I'll be happy to read it." Then I looked up at the student. He was wearing a baseball cap, and instead of the usual Nike logo, the hat read, "Felix," in bold letters, beside an illustration of Felix the cat. I stared at it in disbelief. "Where'd you get that hat?" I asked. "Oh," my student said, tugging at the cap's bill, "I've had it for years. I never wear hats, but I just felt like putting it on this morning." There was a pause between us. "Felix was my father's name," I said, and I saw my student's face go white. My father was always a trickster in life. One dime found in a plate glass window, suspended behind a dusty cardboard poster in the front window of a store where I stopped to use the bathroom. Dimes on deserted walking trails through the woods. Dimes in bathroom hallways, in elevators, under theater chairs. A dime resting on top of my computer tower, where there was no dime 10 minutes before. One dime on the silver tray of the checkout counter where I go to buy office supplies. In another store, a woman fumbles with her money, and I wait behind her, artichoke hearts and sun-dried tomatoes in hand. A single coin escapes her change purse, bounces down the counter, coming to a rolling stop at my feet. It's a dime. I stop in the office of my friend. She has a dime sitting on her immaculate desktop. "Where'd the dime come from?" I ask. "Oh, I don't know," she says. "I just found it on the floor of the closet." Athens, Greece, 6 a.m. I'm the first one to be picked up by the tour bus that will take me to Delphi, the dwelling place of Apollo, considered by Greeks to be the center of the earth. The bus is spotless, just cleaned. I move from seat to seat, trying to decide what will be the best view. I have so many choices. When I finally settle on my third choice, the 10th row from the front, right side, I put my purse on the floor, and there beside it. Oh, come on now. That's just showing off. €1 10-cent coin. A few years ago, long after my father's death, while I was home visiting, my mother was going through her cassette tapes. She was looking for an empty tape so she could dub some music she liked for me. All the cassette tapes were unmarked, so she had to put each one into the tape player and listen to find out what it contained. This is how we came upon a recording of the Statler brothers singing Flowers on the Wall, with my father's voice somehow mixed in, singing a ghostly second tenor part. My mother let the tape run. We sat at the kitchen table listening in amazement. "Where did this come from?" I asked. He was at it again, making crazy harmony, winding his voice around all the other parts. "I don't know," my mother said. "He used to sit in front of the stereo and play these records over and over." I realized that he must have used the mini microphone on the boombox to record himself, singing along with the record. When I told my mother, we shook our heads and laughed. It was good to hear his reedy voice lifted up once again in song. Do the dead ever leave us? Do they watch over us as we sleep? I had a dream about my father several months after he died. He was so frail. Lying on a cot in an empty room, his skin was jaundiced. He could barely speak. His small chest rose and fell. I could see that just for him to breathe was an effort. His face was bony as he smiled at me. His teeth were brown and falling out. He had only a few stubborn wisps of hair springing from his scalp. I felt terrible, seeing the state he was in. He was always so careful about his appearance. Now he was disheveled and small enough to hold in my arms. I sat down beside his bed and started to cry. "What's wrong?" he asked in the tender voice I remembered from childhood. "I never came back to see you," I confessed. "When you were sick in the hospital, I never told you that I love you." He took a deep breath and rested his head against the pillow. He waved his hand in dismissal. "Of course you did," he said. His voice was a thin breeze moving through an empty chest. "Of course you did." Epilogue. Sustainable Agriculture. The Farmer's Daughter Revisited. A traveling salesman is driving alone late at night. He loses his way on a back road and knocks on a farmer's door. He asks for a place to sleep. Opening lines to all farmer's daughter jokes. She waits, as all farmer's daughters must, in her bedroom at the top of the wooden staircase, along the balustrade, down the creaky hallway to the right. The light from her window glows golden through lace curtains and spreads like a beacon across the tilled fields, the thick black furrows, and hundreds of acres belonging only to the farmer that roll in waves around the farmhouse. It's important to know that the farmer's daughter is beautiful, that her beauty is like the sound of one hand clapping, not in the forest, but in a cornfield or a wheat field, where she goes during the lonely days to spin in the ripeness, oblivious of her beauty, which is the same oblivious corn-fed beauty and the same oblivious wheat field her mother spun in. The traveling salesman is out there in the darkness, driving lost along the section lines, his product samples shuddering in the back seat with each washboard rut. He squints and downshifts. He rubs the windshield with the ragged sleeve of his suit coat and drives on, road-weary and blind, going deeper into the dark rural night. "This must be the middle of nowhere," the traveling salesman thinks. "The place of alien corn, where the locals are friendly but suspicious, where the pitchforks are menacing." His maps lie unconsulted and twisted in fat folds at his feet. Across many miles and states, his product samples for hybrid corn or aluminum siding, wire brushes or miraculous cleaning solutions shift and sway, bristle and slosh in the back seat behind him. One thing about the traveling salesman, he's good at neither travel nor sales. He never displays the products or demonstrates them to anyone. They ride in the back of the Buick like closely held government secrets. He inherited this job from his father, who was retiring after 30 years of service, who was talkative and backslapping, a natural salesman. This traveling salesman, the son, is reticent and inward, a shy homebody. Down the gravel road and to the left, the farmer sits inside the farmhouse at his kitchen table, where all farmers must sit at the end of the day. He wears a clean white t-shirt and overalls. The bronze Oshkosh buckles shine on his thick chest. The chores are finished. The cows are milked. The straw is spread. He is busy now reloading the shotgun shells he has emptied while shooting clay pigeons or chasing vermin from the yard. Whatever dares to enter the farmer's yard, fox, skunk, traveling salesman, could come to know the experienced end of the farmer's shotgun. Maybe, maybe not. His neck is red and leathery from driving the tractor all day in the sun. But he is no redneck. He has many fertile, rolling acres to defend. He must remain vigilant. A cone of light shines over his bent head as he sits at the kitchen table, weighing gunpowder on a scale, packing the wad of buckshot into the spent hulls. The small, rounded BBs run down a funnel into the long, empty cartridge. He packs the shot tighter with his blunt thumb, then places the cartridge in the reloader, which compresses the wad and crimps the ends. When finished, he lines up the shotgun shells, brass caps down, on the kitchen table. They gather in neat ranks, like corn rows, or like grain silos. The farmer is a farmer, after all. He must arrange things in rows. Outside, a calm green evening unfolds. The spring air is crisp and cool, with a dewy edge. The vapor light buzzes to life, shining a megaphone of brightness onto the farmyard. Moths and mosquitoes and fireflies circle and rise, driven toward the sudden light. Upstairs in her bedroom, the farmer's daughter reclines on her four-poster bed, reading a book, her head propped against a pillow. Her long hair spreads, silky as a spider web, around her. For the record, she is not busty or pigtailed or wearing a checkered cotton shirt cross-tied at the navel. She lies on the bed, fresh from a shower, wearing an oversized Rolling Stones t-shirt, her long legs crossed. As she reads, she bobs a delicate foot, her only sign of impatience. The knock on the farmer's front door, when it comes, is not expected nor a surprise. It is neither too loud nor too soft. It is just right. The farmer rises from his chair and turns on the porch light. Through the window, he sees the young face of the traveling salesman. The wavy brown hair, the gaunt features, the dark, worried eyes. "Sorry to bother you so late," the salesman says when the door opens, his hat brim shifting in his large hands. The salesman glances into the lighted kitchen, sees the neat row of shotgun shells lined up on the table. He notes the presence of the polished Winchester with its two holes like nostrils propped on its wooden stock in the corner. "I'm driving and I'm lost," the traveling salesman says to the farmer, swallowing hard, finding the words almost against his will. "And I'm wondering if I could trouble you for a place to sleep?" The farmer wonders, could this be his traveling salesman? He notes the height of the boy, almost 6 feet, and the solid width of his shoulders, although thin under his dark suit. The farmer knows this is his moment. Everything depends on his answer. Should he say, "We're a little tight on space since the hired hand's sleeping in the spare room," as other farmers have said in the past? Should he offer to let the traveling salesman sleep in the barn? Not in this day and age. The farmer shifts in the doorway and considers. "You'll have to share a room with my daughter," he finally relents, understanding that this is the only answer a farmer can give in response to a traveling salesman's request for a place to sleep. Then he adds, significantly, "But don't you dare touch her." Why is there never a farmer's wife in the story? Why never a farmer's son? The failure to produce sons is what drove the farmer's wife finally away. All those scowls from her husband in the pew on Sunday when the sermon turned to the subject of being fruitful and multiplying the earth. The farmer's wife is now a waitress in Topeka, or St. Paul, where she dates a beefy, amorous truck driver who only comes around on the weekends. This suits the farmer's wife just fine. She likes having her weekdays to herself. The hired hand, Hans or Ole, is indeed upstairs in the spare bedroom, perhaps whittling a long stick into a sharp point, or lying on his bed reading Popular Mechanics. He has large, fumbling hands and cowlicks, and a toothy guffaw that bursts out of him when nothing especially funny has been said. In the beginning, the farmer had designs for the hired hand, perhaps a conjugal union with his daughter. But that was before he realized that the boy is no good with animals and not remotely interested in things that grow. The hired hand is happiest when something on the farm breaks, when the baler stops twining, or the John Deere's engine stalls in the middle of a field, or a plow disc shatters against a buried boulder. His enthusiasm at these moments infuriates the farmer, who only keeps the hired hand around now because he's an ox with heavy loads and a genius with equipment. The hired hand is saving money to attend auto mechanic school in the fall at the nearby community college, although the farmer does not know this. The farmer's daughter hears the traveling salesman coming through the house a long way off, his small leather suitcase bumping against the balusters, the footsteps creaking slowly along the dark upstairs hallway. She rises, leaving her book open, face down, on the bed. She knows she only has a few minutes. She switches off the overhead light and clicks on the black light. The room goes dark, then a buzzing violet phosphorescence rises in the room. Ghostly letters emerge from posters on the wall, announcing rock concerts she has not been able to attend. Woodstock, Monterey, Altamont. Her white teeth and her white Rolling Stones t-shirt with the wild red lips and tongue light up in the darkness. She turns to face her record collection stacked tall in milk crates along the wall. She thumbs through and finds the album she wants. Physical Graffiti. She twirls the vinyl between her fingers, centers the record on the turntable, and searches for track 6. Kashmir. The needle settles with a scratch into the groove just as she hears the first timid knock. Come in, she sings. She plops down on her bed and picks up her book. From the speakers, the guitars crunch out the ascending chords. The door creaks open. The traveling salesman fills the doorway, worn black suit, long arms, shabby leather suitcase. The singer's voice goes, ah, ah. Don't tell me, let me guess, the farmer's daughter says from behind her book, pretending not to look at the traveling salesman. Lost on a country road, she adjusts the pillow behind her head. Needed a place to sleep. She thumbs through the pages of her book. Martin Heidegger's Being in Time. Trying to recall the last part she read. Something about the mystery and arbitrariness of what and where and to whom one is born. Yes, I'm afraid so, the traveling salesman says with resignation. That's exactly what happened. He moves into the dark room and drops his suitcase. The bedroom is made small by his height. He takes off his jacket. The wide shoulders of his white shirt glow in the black light. As he bends to click open the latches of his suitcase, the farmer's daughter cranes her neck to see the shape and size of the salesman's hands, to note the way his fingers negotiate surfaces. The farmer's daughter has a thing about hands. She could never love a man unless she first loved his hands. Well, okay, she concedes, seeing enough. She pats the empty side of the bed. I guess we're in this together. The farmer's daughter leans over and opens a small drawer by her bedside table. From it, she draws out a baggie containing many long, robust twists of green-gold marijuana buds with auburn filaments shot through them. No sense in making it hard on each other, she says. The traveling salesman stares incredulous at the farmer's daughter. You can get that stuff out here? He means to say, in the middle of nowhere, but stops himself. He removes his size 11 shoes and drops them with a loud thump on the wood floor. In the room below, the farmer, lying in bed, reading true crime mysteries, takes note of this sound. The farmer's daughter pulls 2 zigzags from the slim white pack and licks a gluey edge. She affixes it to the other zigzag with her forefinger and fans the paper in the air. For your information, she says, bunching the weed in the paper crease and rolling up the joint in one quick swipe, there's more than hard Durham wheat growing on the North 40. She licks the glue, twists together the ends, and smooths out the edges of the paper with her tongue. Well, obviously we're not going to be able to finish this book today, as I had thought perhaps we would, but next time for sure. You have been listening to the KHOI Community Bookshelf, which you can hear every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at this time. We have been reading Deborah Marquardt's The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. Professor Marquardt teaches in the English department at Iowa State University and is director of the Creative Writing Program there. This program is produced by Mary Richards, assistant producer Janet Kloss, and chief engineer Rick Morrison. Comments and suggestions can be directed to khoiradio@gmail.com or 515-292-2878. This is Mary Richards. Thanks for listening.